Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. It is our great pleasure to be with Dr. Richard Jackson, who directs the National Center for Environmental Health at the CDC here in Atlanta. You and I met one very early morning because I have environmentally induced asthma. And I have it because I did just what the doctor orders. I spent a lot of time outside exercising, and my result was asthma. There is a big subject around what kind of air do we have on this planet. And when you talk about these particular things and what can we do, the factoring in of air quality and things like asthma, are that's personal. How do we begin to say, this is a small planet, the air doesn't stop at any national boundary, and we've got some work to do if we're not all going to end up with diseased lungs?
Asthma is very important. We've seen a doubling in the rate of asthma in the United States over the last 20, 25 years. When I was a young pediatrician, I might see one or two children a night come in with asthma attacks. It's routine in some of the big emergency rooms now to see 10, 20 a night.
Kids can't breathe?
Most emergency rooms now have, emergency departments have actually asthma treatment rooms set aside because it has become so prevalent. I was visiting a school up in New York. A third of the children had diagnosed asthma. Many schools, the nurses dealing with inhalers a great deal of the time. So asthma is a tremendous issue in our society. It costs literally billions of dollars. It's very tough on families. If mom has to spend, or mom and dad have to spend hours in an emergency room during the night, imagine how well one's going to function at work the next day and how well that child is going to function at school the next day. A couple interesting things I want to mention about asthma. One is bad air quality makes it worse. CDC, along with colleagues at Emory and Georgia Tech, did a study during the Olympic Games here in Atlanta. And what we saw was the air quality in Atlanta improved enormously during the Olympics. People were told, take public transportation, don't drive. The highways were very empty. The city was really fun. It was filled with people and energy.
It was great.
It was absolutely great.
And it was because the cars were not there that are such a signature of Atlanta.
But air quality improved about 30% during that time. And one of our young docs very cleverly said, gee, wouldn't it be interesting in this natural experiment to see if asthma hospital admissions went down and emergency room visits went down during the 2 weeks of the Olympics. And so we went out with colleagues and did this study, and lo and behold, they went down, depending on which way you looked at it, somewhere between 10% and 30% during those 2 weeks compared to before, after, and the year before.
That's just boom. That's 2 weeks.
And he also looked at other diseases. They didn't go down. It was just asthma and the ones that were related to air quality. Rob McConnell out in Los Angeles did a study looking at kids that were going off to high school, and these were young high school athletes. Six of the schools were highly polluted areas. Six of the schools were in low pollution areas. At the end of 4 years, which schools do you think had twice the rate of kids, young athletes with asthma?
This is not a trick question.
It was the schools and the polluter. But see, there's a lot of debate going on. Oh, you know, how bad is it or all the rest? These are the natural experiments. And you can put people in, you know, chambers and measure all this stuff. But bad air is not good when you've got a reactive airway disease.
I came across I was reading through some of your materials. I think it was the report you did on regional environmental health. And there was a line in there that said, you know, breathing the air is bad for you. And I read past it, and then I said, wait a minute. It said that in August, being outside and breathing the air was bad for you. That's a pretty serious indictment or statement.
And you could say that all over the world.
There is a lot we could do about much more efficient use of fuels, for example. Half of our air pollution in most American cities comes from burning fossil fuels to make electricity. Well, if we used less electricity because of better design and the rest, that's to the good. And, you know, more efficient plants, that's to the good. And the other half of pollution comes from transportation, cars. And if each one of us drove 2-3 miles less, kept the car in tune, and or took mass transit or walked much more of the time, that would be very much to the good. So there's there are things we can do today. Yes, we have to design new technologies and the rest, but there are a lot of things in common sense that we could do today to improve air quality at the same time. I just want to touch on one other issue, which is that we do spend a lot of our time indoors, most of our time indoors, and indoor air quality is also very important. And the number one issue around indoor air quality in America is still tobacco smoke. And smokers should not be in the house with kids, with asthmatics. They probably shouldn't be smoking anyway, but at least as a first step, that's one that we can absolutely do. I also think there are issues that we could do about better design of buildings, air handling systems. If you have asthma or your child has asthma, make sure that furnace filter is high quality and changed all the time. There are a lot of things you can do as well.
Again, for a doctor to be the environmentalist is a very interesting look, because you're looking at the whole person, and the whole person as part of a whole system, and standing with you, behind you, a map of one world.
I tell my sons, I have three teenage sons, and I say that most doctors take care of one patient. I take care of one patient, but the patient has 300 million cells, not just one.
And that's...
The population of the U.S., although CDC has extensive overseas work and interests.
Well, and these environmental issues, I would assume, in very real ways, connect you to the rest of the world, because we aren't isolated. I mean, China puts pollutants in the air, and they land in Europe, they land in the Arctic, and some of it lands here. But we are connected by those flows of material around the world.
Well, it isn't just China. We generate most of the greenhouse gases that then affect the entire planet. But please don't go too far from that without saying, and those questions also involve environmental justice issues, which is a term that hasn't gotten a lot of currency yet. It's there and it's growing. But the idea that, in fact, people have some rights and that people should have a sense of equity, that not just poor people who live in rough neighborhoods should get the air pollution or the water pollution. This business of environmental justice, again, it seems kind of funny to have a doctor who does environmental stuff, and here we are talking about environmental justice.
Well, you know, look at where the best and most expensive homes are in Los Angeles. They're in the parts of the city that have the best air quality. And it's interesting to think of the economy of that state. It's agriculture, which is damaged very much by air pollution and other kinds of environmental degradation. It's tourism, which is always damaged by environmental degradation. And construction, which is very much influenced by people want to live in places that have good environmental quality, not those that have bad environmental quality. So oftentimes it's said that, you know, we're going to pit environment against costs, but in many ways, many of the environmental things we do that degrade the environment are very, very bad investments. To go back to the lead example.
You were looking at me that you wanted to follow this notion about there are no national boundaries to pollution.
I just want to jump in with one other point, which is it is truly sad and probably completely preventable that if you're poor, you need to be condemned to a bad environment. And why couldn't, you know, there's always going to be poor people, but why couldn't poor people have just as good an environment as people that are better off?
Well, it's sort of... I find myself looking at you and thinking of, and listening to what you're saying and thinking of you as a doctor and wanting you to take out your prescription pad and write out a prescription for now. You can't get me to take it necessarily. There's a little cell that's going to have to go in there. But if you could write that prescription, what would that prescription look like?
I'm a pediatrician as well, and many of the things we've been talking about truly are generational. It took us a whole generation to deal with lead. It took us that long to deal with the big water pollution and air pollution issues. It'll take several generations to regrow the fish stocks and the ocean and the rest. And we very much have to have a long-term view and a vision. And I think number one prescription would be, let's get a vision of healthy people in a healthy world, healthy children in a healthy world, and a world that's beautiful and diverse and full of health. It's very hard to have people healthy when they're desperately poor. Yes, they're going to be poor people, but no one should be desperately poor. And I think economic justice is going to have to be an important part of that.
And this doesn't stop at national borders. When you have desperately poor people in any part of the world, there will be consequences for all parts of the world, especially as travel continues and if you've got infectious pockets and stuff. This sense of a whole, the connectedness, still seems to be, maybe this is one of your current radical ideas whose time is yet to come.
You know, we all have the same biochemical machinery in us. I remember being in debates about carcinogens and someone say, oh, that's just test animals. And, you know, we all have the same DNA, the whole, same physiology, the same enzymes in us. They're stacked in a different way, but we're all connected in many ways. We can learn so much from the natural world about our own well-being. We CDC have been very involved with refugee populations, victims of war and the rest. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of is our staff that go off to the most god-awful places on the face of the earth. One of our staff in 3 months oversaw the immunization of 5 million children in Afghanistan, vitamin A supplementation, cleaning up of this refugee camps and the rest. She oversaw the immunization of more children in 3 months than the Taliban had done in the previous 10 years. And so I think idealistic young people that want to do something and create a healthier world for the future, I mean, what more can we do? And when we get to the end of our lives, if we've made that contribution, we ought to be pretty happy about it.
I think that may be a lifetime opportunity. This is Dr. Richard Jackson, the director of the National Center for Environmental Health, not just illness, environmental health, at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which we all say CDC because it gets out a lot easier and is known around the world. Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return in a moment for a few more minutes with Dr. Richard Jackson.